Anyway, welcome to the session. My name is Kimmo Fors. I'm an architect in the European Center of Excellence focusing on helping our customers and helping our field get our customers moving to the cloud. And I'm joined with, by here by Phil. Right, so you
My name is Phil Cohen. I'm an architect at Kimmo, stationed in the United States with the American Cloud Services teams and help migrate clients up to the cloud.
So, out of curiosity, how many of you are in the midst of a deployment project now? How is it going? Well, was it what you expected? So, like one of the things, so I've been doing cloud deployments now for 5 years or so, and it's interesting, like there's multiple reality, multiple versions of the truth. There's the sales truth, there's the consulting truth, and there's the real truth, right? So what we're trying to do here is, the value proposition of the cloud is great. It's great to be in the cloud once you get there. It may actually be that your journey to the cloud is somewhat bumpy. We've had great deployment stories. We've had not so great deployment stories. And many of those things are depending on technical issues, but more often than not, we see more like organizational, like the organization is not ready to move to the cloud. Their people and processes are not cloud ready or whatnot. So with this session today, what we will cover are kind of the technical things that you need to do on-prem. So the first part of the session has nothing really to do with SharePoint, but it's those crucial building blocks that you need to enable in your environment so that you can go to the cloud. So we'll talk about things like Active Directory cleanup, user principal names, user provisioning, and things like that. So people ask me, so why do I want to tell that story at a SharePoint conference? And the main reason is that we've seen so many times where SharePoint people fail to recognize the importance of looking at those infrastructural pieces. So we'll start by looking at that. What are the things that we need to do on the platform? Then we'll look at more the SharePoint part. So what is it that you need to know about your SharePoint environment in order to move to the cloud? So this is a logical continuum to the session that we had just before lunch. So we're looking at what are the things that you need to do, how to prepare your content for migration to the cloud, what are the things that you need to think about for the deployed applications that you have in order to move them to the cloud. And at the end of the session, I will do a live migration moving a site from my laptop into the European data center in Office 365 just to show you that it's doable and what are the things that you need to look out for. And the key thing there is that we should be able to show you that we can do full fidelity migration. And again, as you all know, we've had our issues with network. So doing a migration to the cloud without a network is kind of painful. So I'll just keep throwing bits up in the air, but they keep falling down. So anyway, but stick around to the end of the session. You'll see a way to sort of move stuff to the cloud. So to prepare the platform. So when MCS is involved in doing cloud deployments, we follow a three-step process, which is, those three steps are we plan, and then we prepare the environment, and then we migrate. So in this session, we assume that we've done with the planning phase, so we're actually looking at those things that you need to do on your environment in order to make that cloud ready. And as with many things in SharePoint land, it all starts with Active Directory. So what are the things we need to make sure that are in place on our on-premises Active Directory infrastructure? So this is really, really important because one of the things to bear in mind with the cloud is that the cloud is actually a bit more stringent on its requirements on Active Directory than your on-premises environments are. So there are a bunch of things that need to be in place in your Active Directory before you can use that to synchronize users into the cloud. So the logical next step after we've prepared our Active Directory will be to plan for our user provisioning. So what is the model? How will we get our users from our on-premises Active Directory or Active Directories into the cloud? What are the tools, what are the processes, and what are requirements? Quite often I get the question, so why do I need to provision users into the cloud? Well, there's three reasons. So if you think of the Office 365 suite, we have Exchange, we have Link, we have SharePoint. So both Link and Exchange, in order to work correctly, need an address book. So, and the way that Exchange is built is that it actually expects the address book come from the same Active Directory forest in which Exchange is built. So in order for our customers in the cloud to have an address book, we need to get objects into the AD in the cloud. So we have a tool and a process for that, and we'll talk about that in detail. So how is that then related to SharePoint? Well, SharePoint doesn't have an address book as such, but we do have the user profile, and we have the people picker. So again, in the cloud, we cannot reach back to your on-premises Active Directory and query for users. So we need to reach into the Active Directory that's running in the cloud, so the Azure Active Directory. So the user provisioning is a key part. And then the last part in the kind of preparation part is making sure that authentication works. So with most of the customers that I work with, we are deploying Active Directory Federation services so that we can get seamless single sign-on, semi-seamless single sign-on experience for users so that they can actually log on using their own credentials rather than having to remember yet another password.
Why do you say semi?
Semi because when you do the first, you get redirected to a login page and you get redirected. So there's some hops. So it's not as seamless as your integrated authentication. So that's the one hop. So since this is such a small room, it would be good to have this as an interactive session. So if you have any questions, shout out. And I mean shout out because I can't see you. So if there's any questions, I'm prepared to take them at any time. Yeah. Because I hate in sessions when the presenters say, let's leave the questions until the end. I have such a bad memory. I forget things. So if you have a question, it's pretty sure that there's other people who have the same question. So just raise your hand, throw a thing at me, and we'll deal with that.
Yeah, or use the mics if you're in the back of the room because there's no way we'd be able to hear you.
Yeah. So in AD, so where do we start? So again, usually most of our deployment projects start with an Active Directory remediation project. And it starts by doing an Active Directory cleanup activity. So why do we need to do that? Again, as I said, the cloud is more stringent in its requirements on data quality in the Active Directory. So there are certain attributes that you have to have for your user objects in order to migrate them to the cloud. So things like the email attribute, the display name attribute, and whatnot. So there's a bunch of attributes that are not really required in an on-premises environment, but are required in the cloud environment. And for those customers who have Exchange, so typically for Exchange customers, their Active Directory data quality tends to be in a better shape. Because why? Because again, Exchange uses the local Active Directory as their address book. But where we've had issues are with customers moving from, let's say, Lotus Domino into the cloud, because in their case, the Domino directory has been their primary directory. So they have not paid attention to the data quality in their Active Directory. So that's typically one of the key activities that needs to be done. And sometimes it takes surprisingly long to get these things done. And one of the reasons that I've seen is the fact that we have had a number of engagements where we have the Active Directory management outsourced to a service provider. So which means that the customer themselves do not have the rights to go and do these bulk changes. So why is that an issue? Well, it's not a technical issue, but it becomes a project management issue. So you need to ensure that in your Office 365 deployment project, you again align with all the stakeholders and all the service managers, so that for, let's say, for AD remediation activities, that the service provider who is hosting your AD is actually has signed up to do those changes that we require from them. So another key attribute that's really, really, well, it's a must thing in an Office 365 deployment is the user principal name. So in Active Directory today, as you know, there's two ways of doing a logon. You can either log on using the domain /user, or you could log on using the user principal name, which is like user@something.com, right? So in Office 365, this is the way that we log on. So we don't log on using a domain /user. We always log on using our UPN. So one thing that we need to ensure in our Active Directory is that all the users have user principal names assigned. And the other thing that we need to make sure is that the UPN suffix, which is the thing after the @, is registered in Office 365. Why is that? Well, that's because when you're doing a logon against Office 365 and you get prompted for the username, and when you enter in joeuser@contoso.com, then our federation infrastructure in the cloud knows that contoso.com has an Active Directory federation infrastructure here and knows where to redirect that user. So UPNs are really, really key. So, and you need to have them, and all of those suffixes need to be registered as domains in Office 365 so that the authentication infrastructure works. And then also, we are, in order to do a successful Office 365 deployment, you need to do some work on your public-facing DNS. The way that we actually validate that you own the domain that you claim to own is by saying that, so let's say I want to register contoso.com DNS. So the way that Office 365 works is it tells me that, okay, so you claim to own contoso.com, prove it to me by adding this attribute into your external facing DNS so that we can validate that you have access to that DNS. So you need to have the people who are managing their DNS. And we've had cases where individual DNS changes have taken weeks because of different service providers, different change management procedures and whatnot. So again, so whenever you're embarking on an Office 365 journey, like these are some of the key things that you must do really, really early in the project. So let me actually dig a bit deeper into some of the things that you need to look out for in your Active Directory. So one thing that's really, really bad in Office 365 space is if you use the recommendations that we had way back when on TechNet, whereby creating domains with .local or something else like that, don't do that. Even worse, we have the ones who still are using sort of single label domains. So rather than having like contoso.com, they have just contoso. So again, for the cloud, it's much better to have domains that are resolvable over the internet. So for most customers, typically the internal domain name and external domain name are same. That's not an issue. Also, subdomains work well. The main consideration there is that when you register your domains against Office 365, you need to do that in a specific order. So as I mentioned, local or single domains, change them. So, well, you can get away by not doing a domain rename or forest rename, but you still need to make sure that you have the local unique UPNs. But actually, there's many good reasons why you should not have the .locals or the single name domains. So one of the recommendations that we have is instead of forcing the users to remember some obscure UPN, if possible, try to use their SMTP address, because people typically remember their email addresses. So again, in a multi-forest environment, you need to think carefully about that, because in multi-forest environments, and if you have forest trusts and UPN routing, you cannot have the same UPN suffix in two forests. So there's a lot of these planning things. Active Directory-wise that you need to do upfront when you're doing your Office 365 deployment. Within A4S, you can have multiple UPN suffixes. So if you have, let's say, a single for a single domain, you can, within that environment, have users with the contoso.com suffix or the Fabricam or Litware or whatnot. So you can have multiple suffixes within the same domain. But again, remember, you need to register them against Office 365. And when you're doing that, you need to provide a switch in the PowerShell commandlet. If you have multiple forests with multiple Active Directory domains, we are working on a FIM-based solution to support multi-forest customers and the cloud. It's not publicly available yet, but if you have those needs, talk to your Microsoft EPG, Office 365 TSPs, and they will sort of guide you how we can embark on that journey. Yeah, so the question is, if I have a... So let me actually paraphrase that question. So what about things where you have, like, mergers and divestitures or AD consolidation projects? So the way that we are actually building the multi-forest capability for Office 365 is that we're trying to build that to be kind of a change-aware, so that it actually takes into account the fact that you may want to merge domains, you may want to slice out a domain, you may actually buy a company and include them. So the plan with the multi-forest is actually to cover all those scenarios. If you already have, so for companies that, let's say we have a joint company of Contoso and Litware in Office 365, and Litware wants to go the other way around. So we can do that, it just requires planning. Effectively, what we would do is we would sort of remove those users to another domain, and then the directory synchronization would remove those users from the cloud. But then we need to pay attention to, do we want, for instance, to keep their mailboxes and whatnot? So again, it's doable, but it requires planning. Mm-hmm. So again, there's marketing truth, there's sales truth, and there's the real truth. So I mentioned, so once we have the Active Directory in shape, so typically the next thing we do is actually initiate user provisioning. So this is how we sort of synchronize objects from your Active Directory into the Azure Active Directory. So again, in this case, we don't synchronize passwords. We just synchronize objects into the cloud so that we can, again, provide the address book services to Exchange, to Link, and the user profiles in SharePoint. One thing to bear in mind, though, is that it's not enough to just synchronize these objects to the cloud to make them kind of Exchange or Link or SharePoint aware. You actually need to assign a license to them. So what we've seen in many cases, if we're trying to resolve users against in SharePoint, for instance, for if my goal is to add Phil permissions into my site collection in Office 365, and if Phil does not have a SharePoint license, I can't add him to my tenancy, to the site collection in my tenancy.
Yeah, it won't resolve in the people picker.
Yeah. So once you've assigned the licenses, then the next time where the profile import's running, it actually takes the user objects from the specified organizational unit in the Azure Active Directory and imports them into the user profile in SharePoint. Again, we only do profile imports one way. So we cannot change user profiles, for instance, in SharePoint and expect them to flow back to your on-premises Active Directory. So the information from your AD to the cloud is one way, with the exception of a handful of attributes that Exchange manages if you have deployed Exchange in Office 365 in a hybrid mode where you're in the process of moving users from on-premises to the cloud. So once you sort of imported the users, you have the user profiles, then after that, they're users, normal users in SharePoint. You would then grant them permissions to SharePoint site collections, and then you could actually optionally consider disabling access so that you would have them in SharePoint, but they would not be allowed to access the environment before you do a business launch. But again, once we get them to the Azure Active Directory, it's more or less the same thing as it is in a normal SharePoint environment. Mm-hmm. So we've done AD cleanup. We now have the users in the cloud. The next step is then how do we actually then manage authentication and authorization? Well, the preferred model for enterprises is actually using Active Directory Federation services. So what steps does that entail? Well, we need ADFS servers. They need to be fault tolerant, because if they're a single point of failure, then if ADFS is down, no one can log on to the cloud. So you need to make sure that you design a highly available ADFS infrastructure. And typically, our recommendation is to have at least two ADFS servers and at least two ADFS proxies. The ADFS proxies are optional, but we have a lot of customers who actually want to use them, because by using the ADFS proxies, you can actually separate the traffic. You can say that, well, these guys are coming from within the corporate network, or these guys are coming outside of the corporate network. It gives us a bit more flexibility in that. And again, since we have multiple of these, you should implement load balancing. Again, we don't care what type of load balancing, but again, make sure that you have a resilient load balancer, preferably one that you can actually intelligently sort of remove nodes and do maintenance activities and then restore them back into the environment. And obviously, again, you need to make sure that your ADFS endpoints are registered in DNS. So typically here, what we recommend, so you have the DNS, you could have an internal DNS pointing directly to your ADFS servers for internal users, and then you have your external ADFS pointing to the ADFS proxies. So then depending on how the users are logging into the environment, if they're within the corporate network, they would go directly to the ADFS servers. If they're coming from the internet, they would come in via the proxies. So what does this mean? This mean infrastructure-wise? Well, typically what this means is five servers, right? So we have directory synchronization, which is one machine. We have two ADFS servers. We have two ADFS proxies. All of these can be virtualized, but again, if you're doing virtualization, don't put all the eggs in the same basket. So typically what we're talking about here is at least two host machines in your data center. So you could move the ADFS proxies to run on Azure, so that is an option. So from the SharePoint, from Office 365 point of view, we don't care where you run it, as long as we can redirect the traffic coming into our data center back to your ADFS endpoints. So once we've done this, we have the whole picture. Then users can log on. But actually, we don't, for enterprises, we actually have multiple options of providing identity. So the thing that I've talked about so far is actually just the federated users, which are people logging on using their corporate credentials. But actually, in SharePoint Online, we have three different identity types. So the thing that we spoke about was the middle one, the federated identity. What we can also do is actually create local accounts in the cloud. So, which is a way that many smaller companies do. So instead of actually having their users federated into the cloud, they would just create cloud users. So you would go into the portal and then just add users, assign a license and whatnot. We have a third component, which is called the external sharing, which is a way for us to easily share out content that we've stored in a SharePoint Online site collection. So this is, and by doing this, we can, this is the easiest way to sort of just simply create, in a simple way, create an extranet. So you could just say that I'm working on this project and I want to invite these three vendors to collaborate. So then I would just invite these three vendors into my site collection. Question? Is there a limit on the number of external users? 10,000? Yeah. I think the limit, well, we used to have a limit of 1,000. I think we've increased that to 10,000. Probably if you have a business case, you can probably get, it's a tricky thing, right? So as a Microsoft shareholder, I would like everyone to pay a license, right? But in reality, so that like, for each tenant we have today, you can invite up to 10,000 external users. Yes. So, yeah. So the first 10,000 are free of charge. You can then purchase additional, and I don't know the pricing, but it's really affordable pricing. Again, for external sharing, it's again looking at the way you do secure software, it is off by default. So within the tenancy, you first have to sort of say that I will allow external sharing in my environment, and then after that, each site collection owner has to make the decision: do they want their site to be, their site owners to be able to invite external users? So we're trying to do it as in as secure fashion as we can. Mm-hmm. So effectively, if you look at then how do these different type of identities authenticate against the environment? Well, the online IDs, they just exist in the cloud. So whenever I'm accessing the environment, I get prompted on my username and password. So username and password management is all happening in the cloud. And but then the interesting part is actually then when we start to, oh, does the clicker work? When we do directory synchronization, we're then actually, as I said, we're taking objects and synchronizing them from one environment to the other one. So we get the user who was in AD actually goes in by the provisioning platform into Azure Active Directory, and from there it goes into the SharePoint Active Directory, and from there we get the user into the user profile. So then for federated users, so when the way that federation works is that we need to have, again, ADFS 2.0, and then when you get, and we need to have a ADFS trust between our ADFS endpoint and the cloud. So not a domain, nothing, not the traditional domain type of trust, it's an ADFS trust. So it's a certificate-based trust that we need to have in place so that the Federation Gateway trusts us. So again, when you're doing then a logon using the username of like joeuser@contoso.com, so again, it's semi-seamless in the sense that Joe user gets redirected to the login page, and when he's typing joeuser@contoso.com, there's a link, oh, you're federated, you need to sign in your corporate premises. So again, the benefit here is for end users with federation, I'm using my corporate credentials to log on. So again, I don't have to remember two passwords. But again, nowadays, people have so many passwords, so is that a big thing? But for corporate data, it is actually really important. So again, single credentials. Again, for the online IDs, again, the authentication takes place 100% in the cloud. So your password is in the Azure Active Directory. So that means for a user, you have separate credentials to log on to your corporate network and another credential to log on to the cloud. So then for the IT admins, if you look at what are the requirements for federation, well, first of all, we need to implement directory synchronization because, again, we need to get these objects in the cloud so that we can do the redirection back to your Active Directory federation endpoints. The other benefits we have here is that the password policies that you have in place on-premises apply for the users using Office 365 as well. And what's even more important is the fact that, well, if a user leaves the company and his account is removed from the AD, effectively at the same time they can no longer access their Office 365 content, again, because authentication happens not against the cloud, but against your on-premises authentication infrastructure. The federation also allows for two-factor authentication, so you have the capabilities of adding stronger authentication options if you're doing federation. So the question was, so when I log on, can I save my credentials? So the way that Outlook does that, so you get the Outlook prompt, so there you can actually save credentials. But for the browser, it's the credentials are valid as long as your session is open or whatever you sort of defined as the sort of the token life size. So well, as long as you keep your Internet Explorer session open and your sort of the token doesn't expire, you can work with it as long as you want. So if you look at the comparison between this, so when should you choose what? Again, the cloud IDs are appropriate for smaller organizations without an active directory on premises, or for organizations that just sort of want to pilot this and want to test this without sort of adding the additional infrastructure in place. So again, this, you can be up and running immediately. The downsides with the cloud identities, as I mentioned, you don't get true single sign-on. You have two sets of credentials, and you have two sets of password policies. So we have the middle option, where you are using your sort of cloud users to pre-populate the cloud, but then you have cloud IDs, sort of cloud passwords for these users. I actually don't see that very often. I usually see it's either the first one or the third one. And like, I would say 100% of my customers are using the third one, where you are actually federating users and using directory synchronization. Why? Because that's the only way that typical corporate security allows the usage of Office 365. So those are the things that you need to do on premises sort of to become service ready so that you can start consuming the service. So let's now dig a bit deeper on what are the things that you need to assess when looking at your SharePoint infrastructure in order to find out if it's cloud ready or not. So you need to look at, in a way, the big picture from the SharePoint environment, obviously, like product versions, the topology. So do you have multiple web applications? Which service applications are you using? What's your authentication model? Because again, in the cloud, the identities in the cloud are not the same as they're on premises. So there's a bunch of kind of infrastructural things that you need to look at when doing that, sort of to plan the right migration path. So for instance, if we look at the web application one as a specific topic, again, within the cloud, you don't get your own web application. What you do get is a number of site collection within one web application. So that has impact on things like cache settings, web.config settings. You don't have that luxury of being able to sort of customize those things in the cloud. But again, you don't want to do that, because one of the benefits of the cloud is actually it's a service that you consume rather than a service that you can fine-tune as like to your heart's content. If you need that type of flexibility, you could actually consider running your SharePoint environment on Azure, which would give you the full flexibility if you wanted to. Yep. Yeah, so the question was, in an environment where you have like multiple DNS names or multiple URL namespaces in your environment, so how does the cloud deal with it? So within SharePoint Online, the thing that you will get is you'll get one host header site collection. So you can, and that's kind of, you can use that as your public facing SharePoint internet site. You can specify the DNS name for that. But all the other sites, so in a way your intranet within SharePoint Online will all have the same naming convention. They'll be called like HTTP tenant name .sharepoint.com and then /site/site. So they will all be under the SharePoint.com domain, which is like, and this is a consideration that you need to think about if you're moving content from an on-premises environment that has lots of links, because again, those links that used to point to server.contoso.com will now point to contoso.sharepoint.com, blah, blah, blah. So you need to sort of plan for link remediation.
It should be part of the migration effort.
Yes. Right? So once you kind of know the environment, but actually the environment in the cloud is, like, it's a given. So what you will get, as I said, a number of site collections. Then you just need to figure out how can you take the content that you have and map that into what we offer. So with that, I'll actually hand over to Phil, who will talk you through what are the things you need to worry about when doing a content assessment.
Great. Thanks, Kimo. So when you're getting ready to make a move into the cloud, part of what you want to do is look at what you have in your current or on-premises environment. You need to look at things like, where is that information stored? The owners, is it still relevant? Do you want to bring it with you? Does the content source have things that don't lend themselves to being migrated or perhaps shouldn't be migrated? Some examples, you've got size constraints as to what you can load into the cloud environment. So if you're, and also file types that you're restricted from uploading. So if you have 1 gigabyte ISOs stored in your SharePoint farm on-prem, you're not gonna be able to move that. Won't be able to move it because the files are too large. Won't be able to move it because the file type is blocked. A lot of companies have versioning turned on by default. Takes up a lot of storage in older versions of SharePoint. If you're not getting business value from it, get rid of those. Clean it up so that you don't have to, one, move it across the pipes, which is a slow process, and two, because it's going to take up a lot of storage space. Right? Another thing that many companies have, especially if they've been in their existing content management system for a long time, is old content. If you don't have rigorous retention policies and clean up, things just get stale over time. And you know, when you bring content along that's not giving any value, well, one, you could have risk, legal liability, you know, because it's still discoverable if it's available. And second, it really pollutes your search results. So especially when you're starting a new SharePoint environment and people haven't been clicking through the links yet, so it's just based on a crawl, so there's no way to infer which is more important. You really want to clean up the things that shouldn't be surfaced in search because your user experience will be much, much better. When you're doing the assessment, you want to look at the metadata that you want to move, making sure that your tool will be able to do it. Got to look at things like your web applications, how you'll be consolidating them, you know, your site collection structure. Look at the items that you'll be moving across and make sure that your information architecture is appropriate for the cloud. And take advantages of, you know, the SharePoint 2010 or 2013, depending where you're going, so that you're setting up a structure that doesn't require a lot of clicks to get to things, not this large drill down structures. Maybe you're using metadata to isolate things out, or you're taking advantage of the new search features rather than navigating, you know, in the refiners rather than putting everything in separate structures. So we want to define our selection criteria to know what we're bringing along, what we're archiving, what we're deleting, and look at how much is going to be left as to what will actually be moving. And if it's reasonable, you know, if it's what we want to bring forward, that's great. We're ready to move on. If it looks like more content than we either want to pay for, more storage than we want to pay for, or are willing to move across the pipes because, you know, we want to retire someday, you know, then you got to go through and filter it again.
It is an iterative process.
So you actually are doing, you apply the first set of criteria and see what's the outcome. If it's too much, you revisit them. And actually, this is something that you have to work in a collaboration with the people who are sort of looking at what content do you really need. Because at the end of the day, when moving to the cloud, the first sort of a thing that you should think about is like each megabyte or each gigabyte carries a cost. That's usually a good way to drive the discussion with a customer or with a tool vendor. So what's our costing model? So how much would it cost to move everything? And like Phil said, again, we have size limitations. So like we try to encourage that you don't create too large site collections, that you rather have multiple of them. But again, it's all an iterative process. So you need to figure out the right way of having a fact-based discussion rather than an emotional discussion. Because whenever I have a discussion with a customer about how much content do they have, it's typically really hard to give a concrete answer because usually you get the answer, well, we have X gigabyte of storage on our SQL. That's not really the level of detail that we actually need much more deeper understanding of where the content resides. And in order to do that, like we within MCS have an offering where we can actually go and assess the customer environment, and we'll actually show you some of the reports that we've done in that environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to Kimo's point too, when you're looking at that, a lot of companies feel like, you know, will come back and say they've got X terabytes of content or tens of terabytes of content, but it's not necessarily things that they really are going to derive value from having in SharePoint. So they'll look across their source systems, which could be file shares and things, and have, you know, this tremendous amount of content dating back to, well, how old is the company? And there may or may not be value in that content, and just bringing it along is not going to give the best experience when you get into the cloud or into any content management system. This is something we have some tools that we do use on engagements to analyze different sources like SharePoint farms, public folders, file shares, etc. There are many good commercial products that can do assessments like this as well, where you get aging, and by the way, this is output from an engagement. So you can see like this customer, the bulk of their content had been created in the last 3 years, but they were carrying along, and this is from Exchange, from a public folders migration, they were carrying along things that were 7 years old. Their retention policies did not allow for things older than 3 years. This was all stuff that they needed to either clean up or figure out why they needed to have an exception. There may be a valid reason for keeping it, but you want to make sure that you're within your policy or managing the exceptions appropriately. So, as giving you a sense of date, types of files that were old, so older than the cutoff point, we had lots of documents, we had counts of them, we gave the sizes, how much space they were taking up. And by the way, you can see some of the big offenders were Office docs, were taking up a lot of the space and were a lot of the older documents. Here's a breakout of some of the different blocked file types. So you can see down the left-hand side, you know, the BAT files and DLLs that were not going to be able to be uploaded, and where they were located and counts, so that you can then go out and clean that up. So you don't have issues when you're running your migration tool and it's failing on file uploads, right? Plus, it gives you the chance to work with the owners so that they can move it to the appropriate place based on your company policies.
We have a question? So what are recommendations for archival of old data? Well, first of all, like if it's SharePoint, actually, and you don't need to use it, just look at the, like there's archival vendors that have tools. Just, again, the key thing is getting them out of SharePoint so that you're not consuming storage on SQL and you're not cluttering your search indexes. But as to what tool to use, it depends on your needs. So again, we have customers who are just using like SharePoint built-in functionality to do backups of site collections and then by deleting them. We have other ones to sort of integrate more closely into eVaults and things like that. So it very much depends.
Yeah, and some customers are doing things like moving it into Azure Blob Storage, right? Yeah. So they're saying, okay, fine, it doesn't really need to be in SharePoint, doesn't need to be searchable, but I do want it, but I want to retire these servers, right? Because otherwise, what value am I getting from doing a migration? So they're saying, fine, we'll move it up there. But another really good question, though, is do you really need the content anymore at all? So should it be archived or should it be deleted? And that gets into business questions.
So again, as I said, the key thing is kind of having a facts-based discussion rather than an emotional discussion. One other thing, so content is in a way easy. The thing that typically causes pain and misery are applications. So this is a way that we kind of are looking at one way of grouping customizations in different type of buckets, because all of these have different types of of remediation activities. So the first one is kind of end-user-driven customization. So those are just content, so people create lists, people add out-of-the-box web parts to the pages and whatnot. Those are typically not really hard to deal with because there's usually equivalent functionalities in your target environment. Then the second bucket I call authored customizations. So those are things that actually may be things like master pages, page layouts, so things that you have configured and deployed to that environment. So again, for those you need to think, so how could I do the same thing in the cloud? And to sort of plan that. So again, for master page and page layouts, you can still package them in WSPs and then deploy them to site collection. So again, you have a remediation path. But then some of the more complex ones, so where you have compiled code, full trust code running on the farm, again, there's no way that you can take those with you to the cloud. Mm-hmm. So again, a recommendation that I've given most of my on-premises customers is actually start to treat your own SharePoint environment like the cloud. So actually enforcing stricter governance, not allowing people to just sort of purchase customizations or start customization projects without a strong business case.
Yeah. And the end user customizations, there are some out of the box on-prem things that are not supported online. So you have to look at your source environment and look at your target environment and make sure that you're not using things that you won't have in the target environment.
This is a really old chart that I've used for doing like application assessment. It started actually from doing notes-based assessments, but actually it's really applicable to any application assessment. So typically there's two criteria that you need to work, sort of look, so that you can use. So first one is it a data-driven application or is it a process-driven application? Or the other dimension is then, is it something that's out of the box or is it something that's been custom built? So as an example of a data-driven application would be you have a table of data, you have forms for entering data, you have lists for displaying the entered data. There's a process typical there would be that there's integrations to external systems, you have complex workflows, you have custom code for doing activities. So obviously if you look at the complexity and the cost, so if you're down in the left corner, you're typically just data out of the box, there's usually an easy migration path because you're just moving data. If you go up to the right corner, you have custom applications with custom functionality. Again, the cost of those are typically much, much higher. So if you do this kind of a place your applications in these quadrants, and then the more you have, like if you have a lot of applications in the top right-hand corner, then that actually more justifies keeping an on-premises environment for those because the migration cost most likely will be too high. If a bulk load of your applications are in the lower left quadrant, there's probably migration tools that can help you to migrate. Question? So the question was for SSR report. So reporting services, again, moving reporting services type of functionality to the cloud may be tricky because it depends on where the data that you report upon resides. Well, so if you're reporting data that's residing on your within inside of your firewall, it's hard to get at it from the cloud.
Yeah, so, the out of box, the answer is you can't. Right. So if you need SSRS functionality, you typically want to have a hybrid approach, right? And have that on-premises. The reporting, the BI story is better with 2013 than it was with 2010, but it's still not like full SSRS reporting services functionality going back to data that's hosted elsewhere. It's data, it's reporting on data that's in SharePoint.
So one way of the same kind of assessment capability that Phil was showing for content, we have the similar way of looking at deployed customizations. So this is a report where we actually run against an environment and we're seeing that we have, let's say, this most training WSP is actually being used by these number of site collections. So actually having an exercise like this is really important because what you can see here, for instance, is that we have like the sites list customization is used in almost 4,000 site collections. So actually knowing what's deployed and where it is used is really, really important, because then that actually justifies you the discussion of, well, actually this customization is only used in one place. Do we really need it? And if it's a WSP that's only used in one place, that could actually be a good potential for converting into a sandbox solution, right? So again, having a fact-based discussion on content rather than an emotional one that's looking at, well, we think that we don't have, or we think that we do, whatnot. So again, having the facts makes it much easier to have that discussion and scope the remediation requirements. So then if you look at stuff that you need to worry about when you're moving to Office 365 is, as I mentioned, user provisioning is one thing. So why do we care about that? Well, it has an impact. So if we're looking at our stores environment and we have 100 users in our SharePoint site collection and we want to migrate that site collection to the cloud, then it means that we need to have those same 100 users in the cloud with licenses. So again, what if you only have purchased 50 licenses? Well, again, knowing that we need 100, knowing that the source environment has more users than we have room for in the cloud is a really key sort of a pre-assessment thing that you should do before doing the migration. And the other one is sort of a looking at your source environment and looking at the SharePoint features that are deployed to that environment and seeing, do we have those features available in Office 365? So this has been just PowerPoint, so let me actually do a quick demo to sort of a show you a prototype that I'm working on. So this is my on-premises virtual machine running in my laptop. So this is just a standard SharePoint theme site collection. And what I added here are just, if I look at my site members group, I can see that I have Joe Berry and Phil Cohen added into my site collection. So if I then look at what I have in the cloud, so you can look at this list, you can see that Phil is here, but Joe Berry is not. So again, if I would move the content from my source environment into the destination environment, all the content created by Joe would be shown as created by system administrator. So what I've done is created a Visual Studio application that actually, it's command line driven. So let me just quickly show you the way it works. So again, I specify the source URL, the target URL and whatnot. And then when I run this, what it will do, it'll actually talk to the user group web service on my on-premises environment to see which users and groups I have in my on-premises environment. And then, so I'll get a list of all the users in my source environment. So it'll show you that I have four users in this case. So I had Joe and Phil in my members group, and then I have system admin and administrator. So then, in order for me to validate this against the cloud, I'm talking with the people picker web, or the person web service in Office 365 to resolve these users. So I'm calling this web service and passing in the display names of those four users. And then, so again, this is running against the European data center. So that quick, the web service call, and then I just enumerate through all of lists. And then the end result will be, I see that in my environment, I don't have administrator added into my SharePoint environment. I don't have Joe Berry, and I don't have system account. You probably don't want to migrate system account because those are system specific. Again, if you think of this, so for those pre-checks that you need to do before doing migration, this is an easy way to validate my source environment against my target environment so that I know which users are missing. Very, very simple tool. The other one that I have, which is similar to that, is actually I have a feature checker tool. And as you can, I probably need to change my password after this, but anyway, so you can see here that it's a command line tool that I can point at a web service running, a tool that I can point at a site collection, and I'm looking at which features are enabled in that site collection, and I'm checking that against a list of features that are available in Office 365. So if I run this, so as I said, this is still a work in progress, so we're in the motion of sort of packaging this and trying to define the right way of actually making this available to our customers. So as you can clearly see, we're missing some features. And as you can clearly see, we're missing feature 2ACF2. I hate GUIDs. Anyway, so again, as you see, this is a prototype. So what the final version will most likely show you is that we're actually seeing that, like, one of those is the web analytics feature, because web analytics is by default on in your on-premises environment, but it's not available in Office 365. So what does this mean remediation-wise? Well, you need to remediate. You could either just go and deactivate those features, and then still verify, and after deactivation, verify that that site still works, and then you would be good to go. So again, a very trivial way. And again, both of these tools are remote tools, so you can use them against a remote environment. You don't need to run them in your SharePoint environment. So again, the key thing that we're trying to drive, you need to get enough information so that you know how to do things. So, sorry? You wish. So, again, for migration, so as I said, we have 15 minutes to go. I will still do a live migration of a site from a virtual machine in Las Vegas into the European data center. But before that, we have a bunch of slides to go through, so I'll be really, really quick. So with migration, again, a high-level plan, figuring out your content cleanup strategy. So as we said, you define your exclusion criteria, your inclusion criteria, so that you get the right amount of data going across the wire. But again, as I said, all the migration to the cloud goes over the wire. So again, don't move anything that's unnecessary to the cloud. So once you've done the content cleanup, you then figure out the how part, which is using migration tools. Again, some of the migration tools are manual labor by people. They upload multiple. You have SharePoint Workspace. You have SkyDrive Pro, whatever. So there are ways to sort of have end users do things as well. But for large scale, typically the manual approach is not what enterprises want. So figuring out for large scale, so what's your process? Do you need staging environments? What tools you need in order to do these migrations? And then when you sort of plan your information architecture, again, as we said, you don't get your own web application in the cloud. You get a number of site collections. So one of the things that you need to plan in your information architecture is, will you have a large number of shallow site collections, or will you have a smaller number of deeper site collection hierarchies? Again, because that maps into your migration plan. Another things to consider, on-premises, you can have as many managed paths as you want. In the cloud, you can't. In cloud, you get those managed paths that are available. Content types, again, if you have the need to sort of have consistency and you have on-premises content types, you need to devise a way to get those content types into the content type hub in Office 365 so that you can get them then replicated across your site collections in your target environment. Clear as mud, right? So again, choosing approach, self-service, tools-based, complex. So again, self-service is, unfortunately, when you're looking at my sites, typically a manual approach is quite often the one that we end up recommending because of the challenges of working against my site host and whatnot. Again, tool-based, so even if you use tools, you need to have someone who's driving it. So again, this is where you're creating your processes, your scripts. You have someone who's operating these tools. Again, the more complex, again, it may be that you need to write custom code for doing remediation activities. Again, the more complex, again, the more I encourage to talk to a consulting company who have a proven track record in doing migrations. Again, so choosing the right tool. Again, there are many good tools available. So if you go to the partner pavilion, you can see a bunch of good vendors with different tools. However, like, there's no one single tool to rule them all. So different tools tend to focus on different things. So some focus more on content, some work focus on application, some work focus on WCM type of content. So some of the things that I encourage you to look out for is, or look for is, again, the feature sets. So does the tool provide, by feature set, some of the typical requests are, do I carry across like the created by, created date, modified date, and things like that? Because those things are really, really important. Because especially if you are in a regulated sector, it may be very important that you can show that this document was actually created 3 years ago and not the creation date is not when it was migrated. So looking at the feature sets, well, for the cloud, the server footprint, if the tool requires a server installation with the cloud, that's no go, because you will not have access to deploy any code to the Office 365 servers. Another one which is interesting is a licensing cost. So what is the costing model for the tool? So do you pay for the tool, or do you pay for the usage of the tool? So is your, or if it's usage, is it per user, or is it per gigabyte or whatnot? So because, again, those things may actually prove out to be quite significant investments. And also, the final one, so are you purchasing the tool, or are you purchasing a tool and consulting? So again, choosing the right tools for your need is really, right, is really important. But if you look at it for any migration project, the keys to success is always, again, it's people, process, realistic timelines, and commitment. So making sure that you have people who understand where you're coming from, you have people who understand where you're going to, you have people who understand like how we should structure the data in the new environment, we have people who understand if we need to do remediation activities, people who know how to write code, and my favorite one, realistic timelines. So again, if you're thinking about if you're moving stuff up to the cloud, everything goes by the network. So that's why proof of concepts and pilots are really, really important so that you can establish realistic throughput expectations. So let's say that I can migrate 500 megs per hour. If I have a terabyte, how many hours will that take? It's simple mathematics. And then make sure that you have risk reserves and whatnot, because quite often I see people just going blind with timelines. If you're saying that I've seen people proposing the same timelines for a 4 gig migration and for a 40 gig or 400 gig. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, if you're moving stuff across the wire, the more data, the longer it'll take. It's the laws of physics. And unfortunately, we don't have wormholes implemented in SharePoint yet.
Yeah, and
other bugs we do, but not wormholes. So.
Yeah, you have to allow time for things to go wrong, for where you need manual intervention. You know, you need to allow for how many shifts am I going to run? Like, if this stops running during the night, you know, is there somebody working 24/7 so that it keeps going? So it's like it's the laws of physics, and then you got to look at your project management and resourcing on top of that to come up with a realistic timeline.
Which boils down to the last thing: you need to have commitment. You need to have a strong steering committee that can say no, or that can find more money if it needs. So again, with the cloud, I already mentioned this a number of times, you must perform this remotely. You can't ship disks or site collection backups to a data center and someone restore them. Another key thing is your user identities are different. So you need to map your on-premises, like the domain / users, into their cloud counterparts. And the final one, again, without a SharePoint license, we cannot resolve the user programmatically. With that, we have 7 minutes to go when I promised you to do a migration. So do you think I can make it in 7 minutes?
Yeah.
It's a really small site, so
It's a terabyte.
Yeah. So let me just show you what I have. So it's a really small size. It has some documents. But the key thing here is it's not the volume here. It's actually the fact that you can see that there's a document created yesterday by Phil. There's some graphics. And we can, just to show that it's not smoke and mirrors, we could actually, I could create a task in the environment.
No, no, he's going off script again.
And I'll, it's not started, due date, well, let's keep it like this. So we have a task in the environment. So what I have is, again, I've created a command line tool that actually takes data from my this machine, packages this, resolves the user identity, again, because I'm running against my domain, it resolves the user identities against the, my tenancy in the cloud, uploads the data, and repackages that information. So again, I'm doing a sub-site just because the network constraints, but just to show you that actually there's, this is actually real. So if I go to my, oh no, yes. So if I look at my all site content, you just see that there's a bar, but without a beer. And there's no subweb call in it. So this is the only subweb I have in my environment. So with that, let me just kick off the migration. And I'll actually talk you through what happens here. So it's actually close to 1 a.m. back home. So I started the migration now. So what I'm doing first is I've learned throughout the years is never to trust input entered by users. So I'm actually validating that all the URLs that I'm providing actually do exist. So they do. And then I'm actually initiating an export from my environment, which I'm taking this site within my site collection. And this is initiating a server task. So that's why I'm actually now in phase two, which is the verification. So I'm kind of waiting for this task to finish. So this is where I need some good jokes. So
that's running in your VM on your laptop.
Yeah, that's running on this machine. So how many cloud consultants does it require to screw in a light bulb? Answer, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Oh.
Oh, shit, they're taping this. Oh, well. I can always... So, again... The export was done. I'm downloading the cab files locally because what I need to do is within those cab files, I have all the user identities. So I need to do a mapping on those domain users to the cloud identities. I'm also doing a small export from the cloud into my local environment. And I'm doing that because I want to see which features are enabled in the cloud versus which features are enabled on-prem. So I'm downloading the file from the cloud. So the next thing that should happen is that I would actually extract those cab files. It looked at the users. You can see here that I did not find Joe Berry and also had an ignorant authority. So my, as you can see, the ignorant authority could not be resolved because we don't have ignorant authorities, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it's a bug in my code. I just, for certain built-in things, I put the word ignore, but in this case, it kind of was a Freudian slip. Anyway, so I was able to see that Joe Berry wasn't there. The next thing that I'm doing actually is compressing the data so that I can move the data from my laptop up to the European data center so I can initiate and import and get the task running. So the way that I wrote this tool is actually, I've learned throughout the years that things go wrong. So this is implemented in a way that it's re-entrenched. So if it crashes, you can just rerun it and it'll pick up where it crashed. Hopefully you've remediated the reason for crash because otherwise it'll crash the same way. But anyway, so it's done in a fault-tolerant fashion. And I'm also implemented this in a way that if you have a large site collection, then you'll actually have multiple cab files. Data files. So I'm doing this in a multi-threaded fashion. So I'm actually trying to be as efficient as I can in sort of a plugging up the network. So I got the data, I compressed the data, it's uploaded to my tenancy in Dublin, and I'm initiating the import in the Office 365 SharePoint Online Farm in Dublin, and it should be done within a minute. So again, the verification means that I wait 30 seconds, I see, is it done? I wait another 30 seconds, is it done? So you should see in a short while that it says everything went well. I do clean up, so I'm a grown-up, so I clean up the thing that I did, so I don't leave stuff running. So what you should see is if I now go back to this page and do a refresh, oh, my request is stuck in immigration. So now you see, actually, I got this site created in my environment. If I look at this, so the same thing, look at the dates, look at the users. I was able to retain dates, user identities, look and feel. If I go to my task, I hope I have a task here that someone buys me a beer. So how long did it take? So I initiated the whole thing at 52:33, and it ended in 4 minutes. So again, this was a small subset of data. But again, it works. We've done this with a large scale environment. So again, so just to show you, we can move data to the cloud. And as I said before, you all come up here with USB keys. This is an offering that we're building, and we want to sort of field test this within MCS first so that you don't have to go through all the pain and misery, so that it's only I that have to go through that. Anyway, with that, I think we are just on time, and we have the final slide, which is just what are some other things that you actually should go and watch during the conference. So some of these you need to do time travel in order to go back in time, but the other, so like the two last ones you can still, so the Thursday one, tomorrow morning, should be a really interesting one for those of you who care about how to do server-to-server authentication using the new OAuth technologies. With that, thanks very much, and I'm just hoping that someone